Hello again. This is part two of my podcast titled, For Some Obscure Reason, The Poles of Helios. We left part one hanging on the word palingenesis, or heroic rebirth, and we talked about its herbivorous cousin, Volkishness. These, I submit, are the magnetic poles of 20th and 21st century anti-liberal politics, much more than, say, the competing French paradigms of racialism and communitarianism, the famous clash of views between Guillaume Faye and Alain de Benoist, the preeminent living thinkers of the European New Right, is really over the primacy of biology or free will in the Volkish domain, well away from the seductive and dangerous dreams of an Aryan destiny. It should be obvious that the motive word here is primacy. There are always elements of determinism and elements of the will in human affairs. In the ontology of whom we are as a people and whom I am, say, as an individual man, biology describes in very extensive detail a qualitative human type, and identity describes the perception of that, the perception of self. In somewhat oversimplified philosophical terms, Volkishness, then, is an ontological debate, but palingenesis is teleological, a striving towards some predicted hyperreality. There is a universality to this model which I find intriguing. For example, the teachings of the Sufis, and for anyone who doesn't know, Sufis are the living practitioners of esoteric Islam. Their teachings tend along one of two paths, either self-perfectionment or union with God. So here again we have the realm of being, exemplified through self-knowledge and inner growth, and we have the paradisiac realm of an experiential hyper-reality. Well, coming back to Earth and away from religion, or away from what, for most of us, is the speculative, can we extrapolate the political polarities of Volkishness and palingenesis into more universal forms? The point here is that intellectuals of the right have too often been more anti-liberal than pro-survivalist. Michael O'Meara has pointed out that de Benoist's early Grecists were primarily concerned to justify their defence of the European heritage. Justification is not really how philosophers should go about their business. They, as my favourite country band sings about the English, need roots. A certain intellectual primogeniture has to obtain. We have to get right back to what really drives us and work from that. Great philosophy, world-changing philosophy, must proceed from the fundamentals, avowing these to be true above all things. No mundane strategizing, no compromising, no treating with the devil, just the unimpeachable truth of an unanswerable comprehension of man. So let's return to this notional polarity. For there are two, just two, great philosophical wellsprings of human endeavor. One of them, which we know all about, is the will to power, a will unfettered in its action, out of which springs the desire felt by all men to be autonomous. This is the teleological one of the pair, of course, and the more propositional and detached from past experience it becomes, the more hyper-real are the benefits it is claimed to bring. This hyper-reality reaches all the way up to the blatant lie, the supreme example of which today is the elusive but always enriching and liberating nirvana of racial diversity. But even if its postmodern forms are corrupted, in itself the desire for freedom is true enough, and it does not stand in opposition to the other great wellspring, only in distinction to it. Put another way, the relatively powerful individualism of European man is an inherited trait, and so is his capacity for love. Now, before mention of that four-letter word curls too many coolly Northern European toes, Let's look at it from an EGI perspective. Standing behind everything is life's imperative to transmit itself through time. In that way, genotype survives even if phenotype does not. Now, we arrive quite quickly from here at Frank Salter's noble exposition of ethnic genetic or reproductive interest as the ultimate value of all living organisms, including genetically definable human populations. The familial love that binds and protects such populations is an evolved survival mechanism. No more, no less. It tells us, through our emotions, how to order the priorities of group survival. I've tested your listening powers long enough without a break, so I'm going to play another musical evocation, this time actually titled Helios and written by the Danish symphonist Carl Nielsen. Again, it's a tone poem, charting the journey of the sun across the heavens and its sinking at dusk into the golden Aegean Sea. Nielsen was living in Athens at the time and finished the piece on April 23, 1903. Unlike Strauss's Alpine Symphony, in which we find the European self enacting with great nature in its own inimitable way, Nielsen's Helios paints for us a picture of the continuity of nature and of man's place within that. It shows us a world that will return again and again. What I particularly liked about it, though, is the way that Volkish brotherhood and collective purpose barge into the piece, almost as though D'Artagnan and his pals had grabbed hold of the hapless Nielsen, no nationalist, I think, and bundled him off to the inn. It ends, incidentally, on two low reverberating notes from a Viking longhorn, a clear statement of the investment of timelessness in Nielsen's own people. And this, indeed, is the ending. Good, well, I hope that a picture is emerging from this of the naturalness and rightness of love of kind. This great philosophical and political principle, universalized out of existence by liberal philosophy and frankly mishandled by anti-liberals, is not just a nationalist alternative to freedom, but comes before it, is senior to it. Again, coming over all Darwinian for a moment, the evolutionary root of the will to power is reproductive fitness, but it is only one of the strategies employed to that end, though a very important one to be sure. Ethnic genetic interest, however, is life's great imperative reflected in us. It is first cause, and the proper place for serious European survivalist thought to take flight. And if EGI itself, literally the number of copies of your or my genes in the world, is too bloodless, too reductionist to inspire such flight, its phenotype, love, is not. Now, there's absolutely nothing new in philosophizing the wellspring of love from the right, and I'm going to finish in a few moments on a third musical excerpt that does exactly that. Imagine for a moment a society in which every member was content with his place, wouldn't wish for anything else, couldn't wish for anything better. The rulers rule, which is what they want, the minions minion, which is all they can conceive. There is no critique, no motive force for change, and so no politics. Such a politically mechanical society is, in fact, the logical end product of all power elitism, since elites seek to preserve their own power and privilege. In The Valkyries, the second drama of Richard Wagner's Great Ring Cycle, which is not in the slightest bloodless or reductionist, there is the particular line sung by the ambitious Albrecht. It is very well known among Wagner fans. I'm not going to attempt the German, but it means, "Only one who renounces love can procure the gold and forge it into the all-powerful ring." Powerful. This dramatic passage is known as the renunciation of love. And if you've ever wondered what the Skull and Bones owl boys are doing with their cremation of care, now you know. At the end of history, or at least at the end of the history of European man, we are, in our own little ways, all Albrechts, all renouncing love. From a purely ideological position, postmodern liberalism holds that the sovereign individual's rights and interests simply include no ethnic rights and interests. If you are European, not even the right of self-defense, not the right to a place of our own to live, not the right to survive, is included in the modern political dispensation. We are become ciphers, you and me, somehow transmogrified into this progressive political form called an individual. We have left behind the truly human, the beautiful, the meaningful. In other words, our lives are officially and selectively sanitized of what we naturally love. Enough. Let our best philosophical minds turn on this. That's what I ask. Post-Psalter, and at this critically late hour, let them construct out of first causes, a genuine replacement for the dying liberal star of individualism. I'm going to finish with a burst of Wagner. The Ring of the Nibelungen runs for over 15 hours in all. The last notes are these, as they were played just last Friday on BBC Radio 3. Listen to the words of the presenter, which include the words of Wagner himself, and which follow.
From the ruins of the half-burnt hall, the men and women perceive with awe the light in the sky, in which now appears the Hall of Valhalla, where the gods and heroes are seen sitting together. Bright flames seize on the abode of the gods, and when this is completely enveloped by them, the curtain falls. Wagner's stage directions for the immolation scene that ends his opera Götterdämmerung, and indeed the whole Ring cycle. The whole order of power and greed is swept away to be replaced by a new world order centred on love, Wagner revealing himself as a true revolutionary and claiming his place in the making of music.